This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, the 1st of July, 2011. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood. Coming up on the newscast, the US Sentencing Commission votes to retroactively even out disparities between convictions for powdered cocaine and crack. Thousands could have their sentences reduced. In Spain, people facing eviction from their homes because of the financial crisis take action against banks. And five New Orleans police officers go on trial, accused of an unprovoked shooting spree following Hurricane Katrina that left two people dead and four others wounded.
One particularly moving part was when she talked of her daughter, who was a teenager, trying to shield her mother with her body to try and keep her from being shot more.
Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Widespread protests erupted in Syria today. Media reports indicate that as many as a dozen people have been killed in clashes with security personnel. Today in Lithuania, U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton issued a warning to the regime of President Bashar al-Assad, saying allowing one meeting of the opposition is not enough to prove there's a legitimate transition towards democracy.
The Syrian government is running out of time. They are either going to allow a serious political process that will include peaceful protests to take place throughout Syria and engage in a productive dialogue with members of the opposition and civil society, or they're going to continue to see increasingly organized resistance.
Government supporters also rallied today across Syria. The Freedom Flotilla II, an international group of ships headed to Gaza in protest of Israeli policy there, has been slowed down by several incidents over the past 2 days. Organizers say two of their ships have had their propellers sabotaged. In addition, Greek authorities prohibited the flotilla ships from leaving Greece for Gaza, but members of the flotilla attempted the crossing anyway. The U.S.-based Audacity of Hope was stopped by the Greek Coast Guard today. A Canadian ship was also blocked from crossing, reports Haaretz. Thailand's major political parties drew large crowds today in final rallies ahead of Sunday's national election. As FSRN's Ron Corbin reports from Bangkok, the rallies also marked the end to 6 weeks of intense campaigns, with the governing Democrat Party lagging in opinion polls.
Under monsoon rains, thousands of supporters of Thailand's governing Democrat Party and opposition Pheu-Thai rallied, making a final push ahead of Sunday's general elections for a new 500-member parliament. Prime Minister and Democrat Party leader Apisit Wechachawa called for national unity and an end to political violence that has plagued Thailand over recent years. Democrat Party member Krysak Chunawon says a strong party base can be counted on going into Sunday's vote.
We do have a base support from the population who has been diehard Democrats. But what we need is an additional perhaps 15 or 20% from the undecided vote.
In opinion polls, the Democrats trail the Pheu-Thai Party, led by Yingluck Shinawat, sister of former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawat, who was overthrown in a coup in 2006. The Thai Election Commission has invited officials from 11 countries to observe Sunday's polls, according to the Thai news agency. The group includes several major regional democracies like Australia, Japan and India, as well as smaller powers like Bhutan, Malaysia and Bangladesh. Ron Corbin, FSRN, Bangkok.
More than 20,000 state workers in Minnesota started their holiday weekend a day early today, whether they wanted to or not. They're at home because state lawmakers could not pass a budget, forcing a government shutdown. For FSRN, Michelle Alamorati reports.
Failing to break the budget stalemate between Democratic Governor Mark Dayton and the Republican-controlled state legislature, the state government was forced to shut down as of midnight last night. This leaves Minnesotans without so-called non-essential state services. Jewish Community Action Director Vic Rosenthal says it's the poorest of residents that will be hit hardest by the shutdown.
Just regular everyday people who have jobs that they depend on in order to pay for their mortgage or pay for the rent in their apartment. They're all going to be affected by this. It's just really sad to have to be doing this when it's a fairly simple problem to be fixed.
The Minnesota Department of Human Services says several grants for housing, food, and mental health services will also be unavailable during the shutdown. Lawmakers will resume efforts to close the budget gap after the holiday weekend. Michelle Alimorati, FSRN, Minneapolis.
Just weeks after the U.S. Supreme Court issued a decision demanding that California release thousands of inmates to alleviate chronic overcrowding, high-security prisoners at Pelican Bay State Prison in Crescent City say they plan to go on hunger strike. From California, FSRN's Hannah Vierkamp has more.
Between 50 and 100 prisoners at Pelican Bay State Prison's Security Housing Unit, known as the SHU, have organized a strike to protest conditions they say are inhumane. Jessica Watcott is with Bar None, a grassroots advocacy organization that has monitored human rights at Pelican Bay for 10 years.
I think that they're just extremely frustrated. They feel like they are at risk of dying in the SHU anyway, and so they feel like they have no other choice but to put their lives on the line to get people to pay attention to what's going on there.
The hunger strikers have issued 5 key demands through the advocacy group California Prison Focus. These include an end to group punishment and policies that coerce prisoners to inform on one another. They are also calling for adequate food, increased opportunities for education, and drastically reduced use of solitary confinement. Hannah Vierkamp, FSRN, Arcata, California.
And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Danny Wood in San Francisco. The U.S. Sentencing Commission has voted unanimously to retroactively apply the Fair Sentencing Act of 2010. The move will even out disparities between those convicted for powdered cocaine and crack offenses. As many as 12,000 prisoners currently incarcerated could have a chance at a reduced sentence. Michael Lawson reports.
Last year, Congress passed the Fair Sentencing Act, reducing the 100-to-1 sentencing disparity between crack cocaine and powdered cocaine. It also eliminated a mandatory minimum for simple possession. Under this disparity, a person possessing 5 grams of crack cocaine would face the same mandatory 5-year sentence as someone possessing 500 grams of powdered cocaine. The U.S. Sentencing Commission amendment, effective November 1st, would retroactively apply the new 18-to-1 guidelines for those currently incarcerated. The amendment applies to convictions dating back to 1987, when the sentencing guidelines were first imposed. William Carr, vice chair of the commission, expressed his approval for retroactive application.
In light of the commission's historical position with respect to crack sentencing and considering Congress's purpose and effect in changing decades of unfair crack mandatory sentencing policy, I think it would be incongruous, if not unconscionable, if we failed to make this amendment retroactive.
Advocates for reducing the disparities lobbied for years for a change to laws, pointing to a clear racial imbalance in convictions. According to figures released by the commission in 2009, African Americans represented 79% of crack cocaine offenders, but only 28% of those convicted under the lighter powdered cocaine statutes. The commission has also found that despite African Americans representing a higher percentage of crack cocaine offenders, whites represent the majority of crack cocaine users. Laura Murphy, director of the ACLU's legislative office in Washington, says the skewed racial component is why the ACLU decided to look at the crack laws 2 decades ago.
We saw such a huge racial disparity in the war on drugs and how it was being prosecuted. So this has probably been one of the most discriminatory laws in terms of its impact on racial minorities in the nation's history.
The Bureau of Prisons estimates a savings of $200 million over 5 years following retroactivity. Studies conducted by the commission showed no difference in the recidivism rate between offenders who served full sentences and those who received reduced sentences under an earlier change in the law. According to data maintained at the King's College in London, the U.S. represents 5% of the world's population, yet contains 25% of the world's prisoners. Murphy says these statistics are the result of a failed war on drugs that should be re-examined in this age of deficit reduction.
We have been on an over-incarceration binge, and it's time for us to re-examine our priorities, because not only is it costly in terms of human potential, but it's ruining state and federal budgets.
Congress does have the option of disapproving the amendment, which, according to Murphy, would be a miscarriage of justice. Last week, Representative Bobby Scott of Virginia introduced bipartisan legislation that would have retroactively applied the provisions of the Fair Sentencing Act. Following the commission's decision, the status of that legislation is unclear. 37 months is the average expected reduction in sentence, but the commission still expects the average term to be 10 years. The Sentencing Commission's guidelines do not apply to sentences given according to state laws. Michael Lawson, FSRN, Washington.
In New Orleans this week, five police officers are on trial for shooting dead two people and wounding four others. The incident occurred in the days following Hurricane Katrina in September 2005 on the city's Danziger Bridge. The police claimed they were responding to gunfire on the bridge. The surviving victims, that include a family and teenagers, say they were unarmed and the police opened fire without warning. Several other incidents of post-Katrina violence involving police are currently being investigated by the Justice Department. Jordan Flaherty is a journalist covering the trial and author of Floodlines: Community and Resistance from Katrina to the Jenna 6. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you. It's an honor to be on.
You've called this one of the most important trials in New Orleans history. Why do you think that?
Well, in this post-Katrina period, we've been having this issue of police violence that has been ignored by our media, by our district attorney, our U.S. attorney. Every check and balance ignored it for years. And so this trial shines a light on an action of a specific group of officers. And by the way, these officers include sergeants and people even higher up in the hierarchy, in some ways even the police chief at the time, if not under charges, at least by implication, pulled into involvement in this. So it shines a light on a systemic problem, an entire department going all the way up the ladder. And I think because it shows these problems, it offers an opportunity for us to really change this criminal justice system.
So what exactly are the police officers charged with?
Well, because basically state charges fell apart, they're charged with federal charges, similar to during the civil rights movement, as you had these, you know, murders of civil rights workers and other African Americans, and the states were unwilling to prosecute, and so you had these federal charges that they would come up under. So the charges are things like deprivation of civil rights under color of law. Basically, they're federal versions of these murder charges. Four of them face life in prison, and one who was not there on the bridge but was involved in the cover-up faces 120 years in prison.
What are the presumably conflicting accounts being heard in this courtroom about the events on Danziger Bridge?
What makes this different about this trial is we also have these officers that have pled guilty in exchange for lesser charges. So we have not just the word of the people that were shot at by the officers, but we also have the word from several of the officers that were there for the shooting and several other officers who were not there but aided in the cover-up. So I think if we go by a combination of the stories of these officers that have pled guilty and the civilians on the bridge, I think we do have a pretty clear picture of a group of unarmed civilians, really two families that were walking separately, walking across this bridge, trying to flee the flooded New Orleans East neighborhood, getting to dry land. A group of officers that had heard a misleading radio call and thought there were armed people at the bridge shooting at officers, and came onto the bridge, basically jumped out of their vehicle and just started shooting. And even when they saw that there were unarmed civilians with no guns, that they continued shooting. And in fact, they went up to people who were lying on the ground cowering and shot at them point blank multiple times. Susan Bartholomew, an African-American woman I think her 30s, was shot so many times her arm was shot off of her body. Ronald Madison, a mentally challenged man, was shot seven times, five times in the back. Another officer then ran up and stomped on him and kicked him until he was dead. James Brissett, a 17-year-old boy in high school, was also shot seven times, and several of them point blank. Jose Holmes, another teenager, was shot several times as he was lying, bleeding. Another officer came up and stood above him and shot him multiple more times while he was lying there bleeding. The senior officers came on the scene and immediately saw that this was a bad shoot and immediately began planning a cover-up. For 4 years, almost 4 years, they continued this cover-up. They had secret meetings. All of this is documented very clearly. For example, the Justice Department seized officers' computers and found where they had saved the old drafts of their reports of the incident as they had written, rewritten what happened.
You've mentioned Susan Bartholomew, who literally had her arm shot off by the police on the bridge, and she was the first prosecution witness to appear. Can you tell us a little bit about what she said in court?
Well, you know, it began when, you know, they asked her to raise her right hand to swear to tell the truth, and she had to raise her left hand because, of course, her right hand was gone. During the prosecution questioning, she was kind of quiet, often near tears, as she talked about crouching down and feeling the officers continue to shoot at her, you know, knowing her family members are by her. One particularly moving part was when she talked of her daughter, I think was 17, a teenager, trying to shield her mother with her body to try and keep her from being shot more.
In the face of these surviving victims like Susan Bartholomew and all this documentary evidence you've mentioned, what sort of case are the defense attorneys for the policemen putting up?
The first one, Paul Fleming, he almost shouted his first words when he said, "These men are not guilty." He basically went on to paint them as hero cops that were doing their jobs. The Justice Department lawyer calling her a liar, calling what she's doing a work of fiction. They almost seem to be trying to find an anti-government feeling in the jury.
Jordan Flaherty, journalist and also staffer with the Louisiana Justice Institute, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Danny.
In Montana and Idaho, environmentalists are preparing to protest a proposed mega-load shipping route along U.S. Highway 12. ExxonMobil wants to use this scenic corridor to transport 500,000-pound shipments of oil extraction equipment by truck to the Alberta-Canada tar sands. From Idaho, Lee Robartes has more.
To Earth First organizer Greg Mack of Moscow, Idaho, it almost goes without saying. The Alberta tar sands are the most environmentally destructive industrial project on the planet. That's why Mack proposed the group hold their annual summer rendezvous along a new transport corridor for Korean-made ExxonMobil tar sands equipment.
We intentionally chose to be off of Scenic Highway 12 because it goes along the Bitterroot Wilderness and the wild and scenic Lacsaw Clearwater River, and we wanted that not to turn into a high and wide corridor that Exxon wants it to turn into to ship these tar sand shipments.
Residents of Idaho and Montana have been fighting ExxonMobil's transport plan in the courts and state bureaucracy since finding out last year about the proposal to ship more than 200 500,000-pound loads from the inland port of Lewiston, Idaho, to the Alberta tar sands. After blocking all but a test shipment for a year, legal options are running out.
We always do a direct action after the rendezvous. There are occasions where it is simply symbolic. But when we can directly stop something that is destroying the planet, we do that. And our rendezvous is July 5th through the 12th. And we always do an action the day after the rendezvous. So that would be the 13th. So if these rigs are rolling on the 13th, we will be stopping them.
That's a big if. In Montana, an environmental lawsuit by Missoula County commissioners and three environmental groups is still pending. A judge this week ruled the lawsuit could move forward, alleging inadequate environmental review by Montana transportation officials. In Idaho, the state Supreme Court rejected a lawsuit brought by owners of tourism and recreation businesses along the nation's first federally designated wild and scenic river corridor. Last year, the High Court told plaintiffs to use a Transportation Department process called a contested case hearing. This week, the hearing officer recommended the Transportation Department issue the permits, and the business owners have until July 11th to appeal. As legal delays continued, Ken Johnson, the transport manager for ExxonMobil Canadian subsidiary Imperial Oil, came to a public meeting in Moscow, Idaho, to answer questions about an alternate route through the city's downtown. Instead of the 30-foot-tall loads, Imperial Oil has sliced some in half so they can fit under overpasses on the alternate route through Moscow.
Our original plan, as I said, and still our preferred route, is US 12. However, due to the permitting delays, just not in in Idaho, but also in Montana, we're forced to go in to reconfigure these modules and move them to the interstate system.
Imperial Oil says it cost them $500,000 to split each megaload in half. The resulting transports will still be two lanes wide and weigh up to 400,000 pounds. Since the split loads can travel on interstates, the Montana lawsuit over environmental impacts on smaller highways won't apply. Moscow resident Brett Haverstick said even though the alternative route along US 95 does not follow a wild and scenic river, there is concern about it becoming a permanent industrial corridor.
How this community will look, how it will feel, and how it functions will be very, very different. And I'm scared about that.
However, a growing number of U.S. residents oppose the shipping proposal because of the cargo and its destination, the Alberta tar sands. Helen Yost of Wild Idaho Rising Tide says Moscow area residents should not be facilitating the damage climate change will bring to both the local area and the entire world.
We rely heavily on our wheat crops and other agriculture here. That's going to be sadly impacted. And all the people that live near the ocean all across the world are going to be damaged and lose their homes, ultimately, because we let these trucks go through.
Local environmentalists at the meeting hinted that if the ExxonMobil shipments begin, they'll consider using civil disobedience to block them. Lee Robartis, FSRN, Moscow, Idaho.
This Monday, July the 4th, FSRN will air a special documentary on the role of hip-hop in the popular uprisings across the Arab world. In countries where censorship has stifled freedom of speech, music and poetry have become the avenues for communicating political dissent. We'll take a look at how youth in Arab nations have adopted a form of expression developed in urban America and adapted it to deliver a message that reflects the reality in their region.
Hip-hop is made to sort of narrate the experiences of people who've been oppressed or marginalized. It gives a voice to people who don't have one.
Tune in for Rhymes and Revolution, soundtrack to the Arab Spring, this July the 4th on FSRN. In Kenya's Dadaab refugee camp, two people are dead and a dozen injured after police fired live ammunition and tear gas at crowds of refugees protesting attempts by officials to demolish housing erected near a food distribution site. The United Nations says a riot broke out and security forces called in more police. Emmanuel Nyabera is spokesperson for the UN Refugee Agency in Kenya.
Police had to look for reinforcement from other police stations to use tear gas to disperse refugees. But that did not work, so they used live weapons to disperse them, and unfortunately, two of them died and 12 were injured.
The two men killed were Somalis who, like more than 60,000 others this year, have fled drought and armed conflict. Dadaab is Africa's largest refugee camp, with a population of more than 370,000. It was built 20 years ago to hold about 90,000. As Greece prepares to receive its next EU-IMF rescue package worth billions of dollars, Spain, with more than 20% unemployment, is another European country suffering severe ongoing effects from the 2008 financial crisis. Before the economic crash, Spain was building more new apartments than France and Germany combined. But like here in the US, many of the tens of thousands of Spaniards who bought houses during the boom years are continuing to fall behind on their mortgage payments and face eviction from their homes. But as Naomi Fowler reports, Spaniards are starting to take action into their own hands.
This is one of many huge demonstrations across Spain. Protesters say there's a lot to be angry about. More than 9 million people are now living in extreme poverty here. Spain has the highest unemployment rate in Europe at 20%, and up to a third of the Spanish workforce have temporary jobs or work as casual labour where employers can hire and fire at will. Now add to that mix the property boom and its spectacular bust. Banks profited on risky mortgage loans while many aspiring homeowners had little chance of ever repaying them. It's had a devastating effect here. The CEO of one of the biggest lenders now estimates 7 million homeowners may default by the end of this year. Repossessions are on the rise, like this one in the north of Spain. Lewis lost his job and got behind with his mortgage. He's due to be evicted today. Neighbours and friends are standing outside the house blocking his gateway. They're joined by the group Plataforma de los Afectados por la Hipoteca, the platform for those affected by mortgages. Together, they're going to try to stop the eviction. Plataforma member Ana Calar.
People are losing their homes, and yet they are left with the same debt as the original mortgage, so they are left indebted for life. They've got nowhere to go, and that's an outrageous injustice. That's why we've mobilized here, and we're not leaving this front gate.
As the police pass through the gate and approach the front door with the bank representative, the group surrounds them and tries to reason with them. Luis is watching through his window. This person has the right to a dignified life, says one protester. Please go back out of the gate, says another.
This is how revolutions begin, with people like you saying no. A peaceful revolution by people who help other citizens with serious problems, like this man. He's called Luis, and he has a son called Locke, who's 9 years old, and they're going to be homeless.
The policemen look very uncomfortable. The bank representative announces she'll suspend the eviction and return in a month's time. She walks away as a member of the Plataforma picks up his megaphone and quotes legally binding pacts signed by the Spanish state. He starts with Article 33 of the Spanish Constitution. All Spaniards have the right to dignified and appropriate housing. The public authorities will promote the necessary conditions to ensure this right is met. Evictions are incompatible with Article 11 of the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights signed by the Spanish state. They should not take place if they make people homeless or expose them to other human rights violations. These tactics have had some success across Spain. The Plataforma also prevented this elderly woman, Maria Teresa Alsina, from being evicted from her tiny apartment. She spent the morning lying in bed crying, waiting for the eviction to start.
They should make a law that helps poor people like us. Please let the world know, let the people know. There are lots of people like me in Spain.
The Plataforma is calling for a moratorium on evictions and property law reform. Until then, they want banks to either write off debt that can never be repaid or renegotiate viable monthly payments with their customers. Where is the logic, they ask, in making mortgage payers homeless? In the current market, their homes are unsellable anyway and will remain empty while their previous occupiers adapt themselves to living with relatives, in shelters or on the street. Naomi Fowler, FSRN, Madrid, Spain.
And that's the program for today and this week. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Thanks for listening. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood.